This is Jeff Blankford with the abbreviated January 11th edition of Takes on the World. A very different January 11th edition than my first program in 2001 on January 11th, in a very different world. And here I've been preempted the first part of my program, and my usual commentary is going to be skipped today. Because I'm going to be speaking, hopefully, with Phil Giraldi, a familiar voice to listeners' Takes on the World, and someone I often turn to when discussing U.S. policies toward Israel and actions of U.S. intelligence agencies, which he has some experience, having served as a CIA case officer and as an Army intelligence officer in Europe and Middle East for 20 years. Phil is a member of VIPS, that's Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and boy, do we need it. And he's currently executive director of the Council for the National Interest, an organization of former U.S. elected and foreign service officials who are convinced the U.S. support for Israel is not in this country's interest. It's a taboo subject for the U.S. media outside of Takes on the World, of course. Phil has been a contributing editor of the American Conservative for 9 years, has written frequently for antiwar.com, and more recently for the UNS Review, where yesterday he posted an article examining the report of our intelligence commissars who claim that the Russians had interfered with the elections. That article, Washington Invented Hacking and Interfering in Elections, is one I strongly recommended to you and what I will be discussing with him this morning. Welcome once again, Phil Giraldi, to Takes on the World.
Thank you very much. Good to be back on.
Yes, I assume you were watching the president-elect, who conveniently got off the air in time for me to call you.
Well, actually, I was with one ear. I was listening to the press conference, and the other ear, I was listening to a CNN's detailed coverage on these latest allegations about a report that, of course, no one has read concerning how Trump is being manipulated by Moscow.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary. I mean, we started a day with this, and his first press conference. And, of course, as expected, the first questions and the last question dealt with Russia. How do you think he handled it?
Well, I was kind of listening to both, and my impression was that he was it's like always when Trump is speaking, he kind of blows hot and cold, and he comes out with kind of a reasonable statement saying that a lot of this stuff that's floating out there is what we're now referring to as false stories and fake news. And then he kind of goes on about how he can't trust the intelligence agencies and how the media is not to be trusted either. You know, certainly, to a certain extent, you can make those claims, but the fact is they when you start pretending that it's 100% and that everyone is your enemy, you start to sound like Dick Nixon.
and everything is superlative. Either something's the worst or outstanding. There's no in between, no gray zones for him. His attacks on the media, of course, CNN is one that helped promote him to the presidency. I guess they may have some second thoughts of it. But you know, getting back to this. One of the things that you've observed, I've observed, is there's kind of been a relentless wave of warmongering toward Russia with accusations of Russian aggression, Russian invasion of Ukraine. National Public Radio, at least once every hour, has somebody commenting on the Russian hacking, on Russian aggression, and Vladimir Putin's involvement. Isn't this a bit much, given that there wasn't really any hard evidence, at least what was released in the classified report?
Yeah, to me, this is the most serious issue. It's not a question of Trump, because we've all known what Trump was like for months now. But the serious question is, what is the proper relationship of the United States with Russia. Russia is the only country in the world that can destroy the United States, and vice versa, of course. And so the relationship is of critical importance. But yet, all we're getting is propaganda. We're getting this constant depiction of how the United States is the victim in all of this, and how Russia is this horrible aggressor. Putin is an old-fashioned nationalist, and there are a lot of bad things that he's done. But the fact is, he's a guy we have to learn to live with and deal with. And Trump actually does concede that. The fact is that I've been watching this, and it's a tidal wave, or it's of hysteria that's being promoted largely by the media, but also by some politicians about Russia. And this can only have a bad outcome. So people should be thinking of the consequences of what they're saying, particularly when what they're saying, as you note, is not backed up by a single shred of evidence.
You know, it's interesting. When you read the mainstream media, the New York Times had a story the other day, which the beginning of the story was like blasting Moscow. And then in the middle of the story, people followed it down. The New York Times reporter, Scott Shane, actually noticed that there was the report was lacking in substance, and that the message from the intelligence community was, trust us. And what's really remarkable is their major conclusion was that the Russians supported Trump and opposed Clinton, and they didn't need to have intelligence agencies come up with something like that. It was pretty obviously why.
And then the other accusation, of course, was that Russian television stations that are owned by the government, like Russia Today, RT International, were making an effort to sway the election. How many people do you know that watch RT International regularly, and how many of them do you think were swayed by what was appearing on RT International to change their votes? I mean, the whole argument is ridiculous.
Well, most Americans don't even know it exists, and of course, they have on every day. They have Tom Hartman, who was more anti-Trump, pro-Hillary than almost anybody else on the air. They have two programs hosted by Larry King, who used to be with CNN, and Ed Schultz from MSNBC. But they make it appear as if it's some Russian propaganda operation that's going into American homes, and most Americans don't even know it exists.
Yeah, and the evidence they cited in this report they released on Friday, as some friends of mine have noted, most of it was compiled in 2012. They cited programs on RT that don't even exist anymore, that haven't existed for well over a year. I mean, if this is the best our intelligence community can come up with to make a case for Russia trying to overthrow our democratic system, the whole thing is absurd. And again, the real bad part of this is that there are consequences to this. I mean, the opinion polls in Russia seem to indicate that the Russian people are kind of preparing themselves for war because they hear all this negative stuff about them coming from the United States every single day. And if you're gonna make a case for war, at least give us some evidence that someone is threatening us in an existential way. And I don't see any of that.
And, of course, much less attention has been paid to the fact that the United States just sent a major shipment of arms for NATO forces that will be stationed close to the Russian border. And what kind of message is that? Particularly when the commanding officer says this is the first of many shipments, and he sounds like he's ready to go to war.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I noted that too. Obviously, we've sent more troops over there. We've sent tanks back there for the first time since the end of the Cold War, and also there was the Obama PNGing of 35 Russian diplomats at the end of last year. This was a crazy overreaction to a case that's not being made. If these guys were spies or these guys were doing this or doing that, let's have some evidence. Let's have a little corroboration instead of just punishing Russia to show that we can do it. And that's exactly what Obama's been doing.
And they say the allegation was made without any credibility that these 35 Russians were all intelligence agents. Yeah. And some of them were out in San Francisco. I don't know what kind of intelligence they were getting there, maybe checking the coastline. But it seems, I don't even remember during the Cold War that things were as wacky in statements that are being made today by the Obama administration.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think this, for some reason, at the end of his term, he's gotten a little crazy on this issue. And there are a number of plausible arguments, I think, that possibly explain this. One of them is that he and people like Ash Carter and his administration, who are convinced that Russia is evil. And I mean, this has been a bipartisan thing, but the Democrats have really been onto this. Hillary Clinton, of course, kept banging and banging on Russia all during the campaign. And obviously, there are people like John McCain and in the Republican Party who are onto the same issue. But these people basically hate Russia. They see Russia as a source of infinite evil in the United States. Against the United States, and they've been playing this tune over and over again. I think they're trying to close down the options that Trump will have to actually re-engage with Russia. I suspect that's what they're doing. And of course, the other argument that one might make is that it's a good explanation for why the Democrats did so poorly in the elections. I think they're trying to make that case also.
Well, certainly. It was no secret that Hillary Clinton would have implemented a no-fly zone over Syria as soon as she had a chance to get into office. Man, I mean, she was the establishment candidate. They were counting on her. She had, which was interesting, the neocons, the Project for New American Century folks like Robert Kagan and Bill Kristol, have really gotten a pass in the U.S. media, for their involvement in orchestrating, helped to orchestrate the Iraq War, and these were the people who were supporting her, and she surrounded herself with. But yet, those people who were supporting Hillary Clinton never talked about this.
Right. That's exactly what happened. I mean, she basically was the neocon candidate. I mean, a lot of them came out openly and said they were supporting her and voting for her, and essentially because she was the war candidate. And Trump, for all his vacillations and everything like that, was essentially saying that Iraq was a failure, that what we're doing in Syria is a failure, and that let's try to talk to Russia. I mean, it was a different message. And if anybody expected Moscow to be watching this and to be even-handed when it knew that Hillary was the one that was going to be confronting them, why would you expect that? I mean, that's what astonishes me most about some of these arguments being made in the media and made by the intelligence community. Why would they be surprised that Russia would prefer to have somebody in that would be willing to talk to them?
And this was their most important conclusion. And yet, there's, as you point out in your article, this was obvious, but they present no anything other but hearsay. There was like no intercepted phone, unencrypted phone calls, or that would involve them actually doing anything. That they would express pleasure over the result is no surprise.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, Putin congratulated Trump right away.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, it's like it's real politique in terms of how you view the world and you view your relationships with other countries. And every country has interests, and we tend to forget that because we've gotten mired in the role of every time Obama comes and George Bush comes out with the expression describing themselves as the leader of the free world. It makes me sick. I mean, nobody voted to make these people leaders of the free world, and we're not. The American Constitution was not written up to justify our presidents going around and showering freedom on people. That's a ridiculous concept, and we've gotten ourselves bound up with this kind of stuff that doesn't make any sense. And then we wonder why other countries resent what we're doing or why they hate us. And there should be no question about that.
No, in your article, you go back over some of our history, and you say one can reasonably argue the Washington started the practice of cyber warfare and has been a longtime practitioner of both regime change and election tampering in its relationship with much of the world. Most Americans barely know that, since what they learn in their history books kind of de-emphasizes the American role in affecting these changes. But you talk about some of those things for our listeners.
Yeah, you can go back to the Spanish-American War, and that was the first kind of breakout of the United States in terms of acquiring colonies and that sort of thing on the European model, and that's when the rot really started. From that point on, the United States was intervening constantly in the former Spanish colonies in the Western Hemisphere. And of course also the Philippines, and this kind of pattern continued until the United States became kind of isolationist in the 30s. But then after the Second World War, we've been intervening everywhere. The examples cited, of course, include Mossadegh in Iran in 1953. We've been all over Latin America. We've been all over Southeast Asia, Middle East. I mean, you can't find a part of the world where the United States has not been intervening, and since 9/11, it's actually been overthrowing governments. And you can cite four or five examples of that, depending how you define it, and certainly a number of other countries that where the United States has used pressure, military pressure, and various kinds of softer intervention to get these governments to change their policies. So we've not been a benevolent hegemon.
Well, and we have this kind of holier-than-thou attitude, and it's interesting, although in watching the first day of the Senate hearing, the so-called intelligence hearing, James Clapper had to admit, had to acknowledge that other countries, we do espionage to other countries as well.
Yeah.
Because you had these senators sitting up there, and all their puffery, particularly Lindsey Graham, just so full of himself, asking leading questions. It's interesting, they have a Senate hearing about these so-called leaks, which, of course, he has gotten more publicity than the leaks did themselves. Mm-hmm. It's as if to say that it would have been better if the public had not known that the Democratic National Committee was sabotaging the Sanders campaign, or what she had said to the Goldman Sachs, which she refused to release when she was running for president. But also it seems that they ignore the FBI's role in talking about her use of email servers, which was a huge story much of the time, and also the Clinton Foundation. The Russians didn't invent that.
Yeah, it's like the story is being rewritten before our very eyes to hide things that are obvious, and they're obvious to anybody who's been paying attention.
Getting back, one of the things that's really intriguing, that this whole, and has been ignored, is that this whole confrontation with Russia seemed to begin with the coup in Ukraine, which no one talks about, but was admitted, in fact, by Victoria Nuland, Hillary's former press spokesperson. Perhaps you could kind of refresh that situation for us.
Yeah, well, I mean, basically, the United States has been engaging in what it euphemistically wants to refer to as democracy promotion. Now, this means basically recreating in a lot of these relatively new nations in Eastern Europe and the Arab world and elsewhere, conditions that are favorable to the United States. In other words, they want to give the United States favorable access for businesses. They want to have these countries create a foreign policy that is reflective of U.S. interests. So it's all this kind of thing. And in the case of Ukraine, the which is, of course, a large country and an important country, the United States, it was revealed, had invested upwards of $5 billion in terms of promoting what it describes as democratic practices in Ukraine. This eventually, of course, led to groups being rather more interactive, and it led eventually to a coup where a government that was described as being pro-Russian, that had been elected democratically, was essentially removed and replaced by another group of criminals that are closer to Washington. I'm saying criminals because both the administration that went out and the administration that came in were full of corrupt individuals who basically were continuing their corrupt practices after they were in office. So eventually the Russians saw their interests threatened in Crimea, particularly where they had a long-term agreement with the Ukraine to base some of their naval units and that kind of thing, and they reacted. So everyone seemingly was surprised by this and has been accusing Russia in the Western media of having invaded Ukraine, which is not exactly true.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because they had 25,000 troops already legally in Ukraine, in Sebastopol, when all this happened, and it was interesting to note that the Ukraine is kind of divided between kind of a pro-European Western half and a pro-Russian Eastern half, and we keep hearing about the Russian invasion of Ukraine, but if Russia actually had invaded Ukraine, they would own it. They obviously supported Russians, pro-Russian Eastern Ukrainians, but the Eastern Ukrainians, I remember following the protests in the Maidan in Kiev, is that they only took place in Western Ukraine. There were no protests against the government, against Yanukovych in the eastern part. It was like in the United States, somebody was having protests, let's say in South Carolina or Alabama, Montgomery, overthrew the government, and people in California were supposed to accept that.
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, put it this way. As you're saying, and what I was trying to say, is that the situation with Ukraine was a lot more complicated than the way it was being presented here. And it was being presented here in a particular way so as to condemn the Russian role, and not to explain other forces and other things that were happening there. As I'm sure you're aware, the current government in Ukraine is dependent on people that parties and groups that we would consider to be fascists. And you know, that kind of is not discussed a whole lot in the U.S. media.
Well, when it's been mentioned, it's usually at the end of an article because the reporters try to get something in about the truth. But the New York Times doesn't want to emphasize that. And so I usually have a kind of rule of thumb. I read always the last two paragraphs of an article. It's sometimes the most important part of the article is in those last two paragraphs.
I think you're right. Obviously, there are a lot of things that they don't want to say, or they feel uncomfortable trying to say, because the editorial policy of a newspaper like the New York Times or the Washington Post is basically hostile to Russia, and that's the way it's going to be.
Well, it's interesting that before Yanukovych had to flee, he had made an agreement with the leading countries of Europe. I mean, with Germany, France, and I think maybe some other, at least one other government in Europe, to hold a new election, which he was going to step down peacefully. And this is when the United States evidently pushed their fascist friends in Kiev to escalate the violence against the government and forced Yanukovych to leave, because if there had been a peaceful transition to power, we wouldn't have this confrontation today. How much do you think this has to do with keeping NATO alive? Because I remember before the Ukraine situation, there were articles in the paper in which people were saying, has NATO outlived its usefulness? And is there a reason for NATO anymore? How much do you think this saber-rattling might not be so much a threat in Russia, but just to justify keeping NATO and the arms industry flourishing?
Well, this is the 600-pound gorilla in the room. The fact is that there are a lot of interests that want basically an unpeaceful world, that essentially want tension to continue, because a lot of people in Washington derive income, derive status, and not just Washington. I mean, this is a universal truth that these defense industries and serve no useful purpose unless you have states of war in various places. And there's certainly a lot of speculation that a lot of the pressure on Trump is coming from people who believe that the United States ultimately needs to have some serious enemies, and serious enemies are people that would require huge budgets to counter, and that would mean countries like Russia and China. So no matter what the real threat from Russia and China is, it doesn't matter. They in a sense are the designated enemies that make the whole system work.
Well, we've seen much less fanfare, the spread of U.S. special forces, military forces all over the continent of Africa.
It's becoming a universal flavor. We have to have a military presence everywhere. I mean, it used to be that somebody did wrote a book a couple of years ago and estimated that there were more than 1,000 U.S. military bases. Now, he was including, I think, embassies that have a military staff and stuff like that. So he was definitely inflating the figure. But the fact was, there are nevertheless hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of U.S. bases overseas. And our enemy, the Russians, in way of comparison, have exactly one, and that's in Syria. So there's a proportionality that's being missed in all this thing. Another thing I told a journalist about a week ago was, we were talking about Russia and the threat posed by Russia. People don't realize, but the entire Russian economy is the size of Italy's. So if it's plausible for a country like Italy with that kind of economy to be taking on the rest of the world or seriously threatening the United States, how do you transfer that or equate that to Russia? Because Russia is basically in the same kind of situation in terms of what it can do, what plausibly it can manage to do in military terms. So it's people have this all out of perspective, and Russia is being equated to the Soviet Union. And if you look at all the numbers and all the declining birth rate in Russia, the fact that when it lost the Soviet Empire, it lost a lot of its resources, it lost a lot of its markets, these comparisons are ridiculous.
Yeah, I think this is this kind of holdover that people identify Russia, despite the fact that Putin is no communist and more capitalist, and there are many capitalists in Russia, and that they have this bogeyman that even that perhaps even surpasses their love for Israel, which goes hand in hand with the neocons, although. Putin and Netanyahu seem to be getting on very well. Of course, there's more than a million Russians in Israel who actually like Putin, and they're getting Russian pensions from the Russian government. So it's an interesting situation where the Russians get along well with Israel, at least on the government level, with Netanyahu and Putin, and Netanyahu and and Lieberman, their Russian and Moldovan prime minister, and even they did a favor for Russia when the absent of the UN, the Israeli delegate, was absent from the UN vote on sanctions against Russia pushed by Washington, which didn't make Washington very happy. But what this also indicates, I mean, what I've seen, you even mentioned the papers, that the other countries in Europe, our main allies in Europe, other than England, Britain, don't have this fear or animosity toward Russia. They would rather get rid of the sanctions and only observe them before, because Russia, the United States pushed them on them. They'd rather do business with Russia. As a matter of fact, they're hurting by not having Russia as a market.
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, the Europeans basically don't have this paranoia about Russia, even though the Second World War is still a living memory in many countries in Europe, and the Russian role and the German role. But the fact is, it seems to be only us, and as you say, the British lapdog to a certain extent, who are playing this game. And we were the ones that were least affected by the Second World War. And so I think this is basically, we have to look elsewhere. You have to look to follow the money. And I think a lot of the neocons, as you note, they are in love with Israel. They will not criticize Israel on any issue ever, no matter what kind of government Israel has, no matter what Israel does. But the fact is, they have nice offices. You know, American Enterprise Institute, I believe their annual budget is $70 million. Foundation for Defense of Democracies is $25 million. These people, if you go downtown and visit with them, they have wonderful offices overlooking the Capitol. They have the guys who sit around and think deep thoughts all day long about the state of the world. They have a secretary who answers the phone for them. You know, they have a personal interest in keeping this kind of stuff going. And I think one should always kind of remember that. These people are essentially people who are quick to sell out, and they will sell out if somebody comes along with a better offer. I don't think they necessarily believe in much of anything.
In other words, they have a vested interest in maintaining a conflict atmosphere. Going back, I remember my first program that I did on this Takes on the World was January 11, 2001, and that was George Bush had just come into office, being elected by the Supreme Court. But there was no frightened, there was no enemy on the agenda. It was like there was a lot of domestic issues, but there was no crisis that elicited a national patriotic response with building up of weaponry, and a very different atmosphere than came after 9/11, which seemed to was the kind of the Pearl Harbor the neocons of PNAC had wanted to get in motion, an enduring war that doesn't seem to have an end. Do you see in the last couple of minutes we have left the effort to effect an end to the fighting in Syria, which now finds Putin with the U.S. ally, Turkey, and Iran, excluding the United States. There's a lot of things going on in the region that indicate some kind of change in relationships, and it would appear that Putin is like a master game player in this.
Yeah, I think, and it's important to bear in mind that, you know, you're right about when Bush came in, what the expectations were. But let's recall that even then, you had people like Wolfowitz who were angling for a war against Iraq, because Iraq was allegedly at that time providing subsidies to Palestinians who were getting killed by the Israeli army and police. And so Iraq was the enemy of Israel, and even before 9/11, there were people like Wolfowitz who were trying to make a case for the United States to move militarily against Iraq. So this is kind of another sub-team that the neocons produce. I mean, Israel is their ultimate loyalty, but at the same time, they have personal interests that they are very conscious of in terms of their status and their entitlements.
Well, on that note, Phil, I want to again thank you for being our guest, and I want folks to go to the UNS Review and read your article, Washington Invented Hacking and Interfering in Elections. And you also have an article about the U.S.-Israel relations, which I also recommend to our listeners. So thanks very much for giving us your viewpoints today from the belly of the beast. I look forward to talking to you again.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Jeff. I enjoyed being on.
My pleasure. Take care. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.